During the past 45 years, I've had the pleasure of leading groups through the whole Bible 135 times. These have been in groups ranging in size from 12 to 700, and including people of all ages. In fact, some of the most interesting trips have been with children. I'll never forget the time we were dealing with an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth in the Old Testament. And one member of the group said, "But didn't Jesus say that we should turn the other cheek?" So I asked the children what they would do if someone knocked out a tooth. They made different suggestions, but Casey, sitting to my right, still small enough that his feet didn't reach the floor, he thoughtfully gave this opinion that if somebody knocked out his tooth, first he'd knock out his tooth, and then he'd turn the other cheek, which of course led to an interesting discussion. And another time, the children were reacting to all the descriptions of God destroying people in the Old Testament because they wouldn't obey. And I asked them, "Did your mother ever say, 'Do what I tell you or I'll kill you'?'" "Yes," the children said gleefully, all of them. Well, I said, "Did your mothers mean it?" And Tina to my left, who was not very old, she said, "Oh, we always know it's just a figure of speech." Well, I said, "When God says, 'Obey me or I'll destroy you,' is that a figure of speech?" And they thought about it. "Does that mean that your mothers love you more than God does?" And they thought that through. And I looked to Casey, thinking he'd surely have something this time. But all he could say was, "Wow, that just didn't make sense, and yet it looked that way." Sometimes the trips have taken even as much as 2 years, but usually 1 year. I remember one trip, there were quite a few elderly people in the group. One lady who was 84 years old got up near the end of the 66 books, and she said, "I have loved the Lord all my life, and I've tried to be a faithful follower. But now I want to tell you that having gone through the books like this, I not only love him, but I like him." And I liked what that implied. Well, the purpose this time will be exactly the same as on all the other occasions, and that is to discover the picture of God in each of the 66 books, meaning the books of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and to see if there is a consistent picture of God throughout the whole Bible. And this means questioning every story, teaching, and event. No story is overlooked, and if possible, all the members of the groups are urged to read the book in the Bible before we meet to talk about it. And one of the benefits of the groups is that it keeps us from overlooking something that maybe doesn't fit in too readily. We pass some difficult story and someone will say, "Why did we miss that one?" We don't want to miss anything. And everybody is free to raise any question about anything in the scripture. Some of these trips through have been recorded and tapes have been sent out, we found, to 118 different countries. And people around the world have sent in questions through the years. And this trip through, we thought we would particularly take note of these accumulated questions that have come in through the years. But a major difference this time is that the main audience is you people who will be listening to the tapes. And so we invite you to raise questions. And at the end of this tape, we'll give you a phone number and address to which, if you wish, you could send us the questions, and we'll include them in the discussion at a later time. But to keep our discussion fresh and to remind us that no two trips are ever the same, a small group of friends have joined me this time. And they will be free, of course, to raise their own questions and to make comments. It's quite possible that when I might venture to answer one of the questions you sent in, that one of them will think that my answer was not too good, and they're free to remind me of that and maybe help with the answer as we go along. Now, to make this all really profitable and useful, at least in my opinion and those of others who've done this, the all-important thing to remember is the basic question. What does this say about God? I've sometimes helped start a group somewhere around the country, going through the Bible book by book, and then later on, some weeks later, I may have gone back to pay them a visit. And I find that they've got all bogged down over some one question. I remember in one educational institution, a group started very enthusiastically, and when I went back, I found they were still discussing whether or not there would be marriage in heaven. And I said, "You've forgotten the question. The question is, what does this say about God?" The same way with the flood. The question is not that this couldn't be raised, but That's not the question if you want to find the picture of God. The question is not how did God get all the animals in the ark and how did he feed them in there. The question is, what kind of a God would drown all but eight? I mean, what would that say about him? So one needs to keep going back to that question, and we'll need to remind each other again to do that. Now, a little more on the introduction as to the purpose for doing this. It does seem clear all through Scripture, from the beginning to the end, that what God desires the most of the people he has created to inhabit his universe is that they be able to trust him, and even be able to trust each other. Trust, sometimes called faith or belief, same word, is the goal. You may recall the story of the earthquake in Philippi, when the doors were broken open and there was danger the prisoners would escape, which would have meant the execution of the jailer for not doing his job well. He came in and fell down at the Apostle Paul's feet and said, "What must I do to be saved?" And we'll come to this story later. Paul replied briefly, "Believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved." Some versions will say, "Have faith, trust," they're all the same. In other words, and many other writers say the same thing, if only we could really trust in God, he as our creator could readily heal the damage done. The number one requirement for salvation and healing is that we be won back to trust God. That seems to come up so often through Scripture. But also in Scripture, there's the warning that it's not safe to trust someone we do not know. God does not ask us to trust him as a stranger. And all too often there are sad stories in the newspapers and on the news about little girls that trusted somebody they didn't know. And God would not ask us to run that risk. Besides, early in the Bible, God is accused of not being worthy of our trust. He's accused of lying, almost on page 2 of the Bible, and you don't trust someone who doesn't tell the truth. Now, trust cannot be commanded, even though God be powerful. Even when a person has been falsely accused of being untrustworthy, claims that he is trustworthy are only claims, only by the demonstration of trustworthiness. Over a long period of time and under a great variety of circumstances, can trust be reestablished and confirmed. And so, in a book later on, in Hebrews 1:1, it says, "In many and various ways God spoke to the fathers by the prophets, all of this to provide evidence upon which we could make up our minds whether or not he can be trusted." But one of the major problems that arises so often is, why so much and why so varied? And I'm wondering how much experience you've all had with this. By the way, I forgot to introduce you here at the beginning. Let me do it. Janie is a mother. She's an experienced accountant. And then seated next to her is Connie, who also is a wife and a mother and a businesswoman. And beside her is Dana. I was going to say she's 12, but she's closer to 13, which is a very important matter. And you're invited to speak up, especially we want your candid insight. Children have a way of telling the truth without inhibition. And then there's Connie's husband, Bob, who is a physician and an anesthesiologist. And I'm very grateful that you would take the time to come and do this. And hopefully we can do it all the way through, and you'll speak with great freedom. Well, now, have you read all the way through, Janie?
No, I haven't.
How many books have you read so far?
About 6. But I've, as a child, you know, heard about certain stories throughout the Bible. But as an adult, have only read through part of the Old Testament.
Did you read that at home, or did you go to Sunday school or something like that to read them?
As a child?
Yes.
I went to a Christian school.
Right, as part of your classwork, you read stories in the Bible. Do you remember your favorite one?
I think I liked Noah's Ark as a child. And my daughter and I both love the story of Joseph.
Now, when you worked on the story of Noah and his ark, did you think much about God, or did you wonder about how perhaps he got the dinosaurs in that boat? And what did you think about?
As a child, I didn't think about the people that were destroyed. I thought more about him saving the 8. But as an adult, I questioned the people that were destroyed.
That's the way the story is usually told, how wonderful of God to save the 8. And it seems almost irreverent to say, but what about the God who drowned all the rest? And as a boy, there was a large red book that my father had with some great old pictures in. And one of the most horrifying ones, though I must admit I turned to it often, was a picture of the last piece of dry ground. And there was a tigress and her cubs and a mother and her babies fighting for that last piece of dry ground. And others were drowning all around. But there was the boat. But I wasn't looking at the boat thinking, how wonderful of God to save those eight in the boat. I was thinking about the folk on that little piece of dry land. And I knew pretty soon the water would come up. And there were little babies there, and they would all be drowned. And, of course, children don't always raise these questions, though Dana might well. Who would do it? We do Genesis next time, and we should look at this a little more. Would gentle Jesus, meek and mild, do it? Or would this be the other one we sometimes call the Father or God? But you remember it as a nice story that put God in a good light because he saved the eight. And never mind the rest.
Yes.
So, as you looked ahead through the rest of the Bible with all 66 books in there, did you think, it's a rather large book and it'll take a long time to read it?
Absolutely.
So when you would read Hebrews 1:1, which maybe you never got to, in many and various ways God spoke to our fathers by the prophets, did it look like a great many and also very various?
Right.
If you wanted to have a book written about you that would lead people to trust you, would you, well, if you were writing it yourself, would you write a book like this? You've read all the way through.
Yes.
Now, if you asked an advertising firm on Madison Avenue to write a book that would put you in the best possible light so people would trust you, would you write a book like this?
I would definitely edit out portions.
Such as, for example, though we haven't, theoretically we haven't got to it yet.
Well, like the book of Judges.
Judges coming up very shortly. Yes. with incredible stories.
And maybe the story of Sodom and Gomorrah.
That's Genesis next time.
And then in Exodus, the killing of the firstborn in Egypt.
Children, what had they done wrong
to
deserve that?
Those might have been left out if I was trying to put my best foot forward.
We need to ask this later on, but would that leave out some very important evidence about God to leave out those difficult stories?
Yes, it would.
Are the difficult stories, to repeat what I said a moment ago, it seems to me that when a person has been accused of being untrustworthy, only by the demonstration of trustworthiness under a great variety of circumstances, particularly difficult ones, I'd want to add that, I think, particularly difficult ones, can trust be reestablished and confirmed. The way God behaves under pleasant circumstances is not as good evidence as the way he handles very difficult circumstances. And you've listed some of those. Danny, you've read all the way through?
No, I haven't.
But you've read a lot of it.
I've read stories. I haven't read it all, though, personally.
Have you ever wished the Bible were a wee bit shorter?
Yeah. Some Bibles have 2,000 pages. Some Bibles have split it up, so you know you're going, wow. You know, some people have read through that several times. You're going, whoa.
Now, that's something we need to bring up in a moment, is the kind of Bible you read, the kind of translation, and we should look at that in a moment. Is there any one book in the Bible that you've read that you would just as soon get along without?
No. Partly because I haven't heard all of them. And the ones I have heard are usually ones with stories in them, and some of them are good stories, so not really.
Have you ever been reading the Bible on your own and found a story you hadn't noticed before, and you've had Bible classes, and you wondered, why wasn't that one included?
Yeah, actually I have, and I know why, because they are a little inappropriate.
Yes, I can remember when I was your age, sitting in church, you know, waiting for the service to begin, and it always seemed like a long time, and I would go through my Bible. And every once in a while I would find something, hey, my parents never mentioned that. And often they'd be very interesting things, and I would want to, but growing up in England, the saying over there was, especially in church, that little boys were to be seen but not heard, and so I couldn't ask my mother, and I'd forget by the time I got home. But then later on I decided I wanted to find out about all of those. I wanted to read every one. Which we'll do. Connie, you've grown up going through all 66.
Well, I'd love to proudly say I've read every single verse all the way through, but I haven't. A lot of the books I've read over and over, I seem to get in the trap that a lot of people do. Start the new year and start in Genesis and go through Exodus and suddenly get bogged down and go, you know, I think I'll start in the New Testament. So then I go whip through Matthew and go, I've read the New Testament many times. And then you go back and you hit and miss throughout the Old Testament. And of course, rely on the stories that you heard as children. And don't think too much to have too many questions until suddenly you get older and you seem to be a little afraid to ask the questions.
Well, thinking back of the fact that God wants us to know him and to trust him, think of many places coming to know God is life eternal. That's because it means you come to admire him, because you've become acquainted with the kind of person he is, which requires information. Did it seem quite apparent that as you read through page by page, it clearly was saying, this is what God is like, this is what God is like, this is what God is like?
No, you really had to start digging. But once you got out of a text here or a memory verse there, which is basically the way I learned it as a child, and really started cross-referencing and reading all the way through and considering that it's a whole book, not just individual books, then it started to be put in a different light.
Because if one could be satisfied that God is trustworthy because he said he is, then we wouldn't need most of this.
Be a short book.
You see? But anybody can make claims. In the news the last few weeks, some people have made some claims that have led people to even their deaths because they trusted him. They certainly didn't have evidence, very persuasive evidence, that he could be trusted. You remember when Philip, it comes up in John 14, asked Jesus, please tell us about the Father, and we'll be satisfied. And Jesus' reply at first was, have I been with you all this time, Philip, and you don't know me? And Philip might have been surprised at that response, because they didn't want to know about Jesus. They knew they liked him. They were comfortable with him, sat and ate with him. Philip says, we want to know about the Father. That is to say, we want to know about the one who's in all these Old Testament books. We want to know about the one who drowned all but eight. We want to know about the one who burned Sodom and Gomorrah and swallowed up Korah, Dathan, and Abiram and burned Nadab and Abihu and said, when you go to battle, kill everybody, including the women and the children. And, you know, the long list of hundreds of stories. Incidentally, the stories we especially tell our children. Hopefully, they're understanding what these stories say. But they were a puzzle to Philip. His question really was, Jesus, could the Father be like you? And Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. If you trust me, you can trust the Father. And as for those difficult stories in the Old Testament, don't take them to mean that I am less trustworthy, less friendly, less approachable than you found me to be. In fact, Jesus could have gone on to say, I'm the one who led Israel through the wilderness. Later, Paul explains that in 1 Corinthians 10:4. That Jesus is the one who led them to the wilderness. So the command to stone Achan, for example, was mine. So, disciples, why don't you ask me how I could do those things? If I want to picture my Father and myself as worthy of your trust, I want you to be my friends even, how could I do all those things? Why don't you ask me? But unfortunately, they never pursued that in the upper room. They were more interested in deciding who would hold the highest positions in the kingdom to come. Sometimes when we've gone through, we've pretended that we only had one book at a time, that is Genesis, then Genesis and Exodus, then Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus. And I've asked the groups, if you only had this book, Genesis, that you read this week, what picture of God would you have? This time, though, I'd like to do it a different way, and we know what's coming. There are 66 books in all. In the light of all the books in the Bible, and even in the light of the Son of God being here and saying, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father, and I'd like you to be my friends, to look at the stories in Genesis and all the ones to follow. For example, in the Gospel of John, Jesus said some words about his Father, which he labeled as very plain. There aren't many passages in Scripture labeled like that. Jesus said, the time has come for me to tell you about my Father, to talk plainly about my Father. And then he went on to say something. He said, there is no need for me to plead with the Father for you, for the Father loves you himself. And then in our reading, we come to Exodus and Leviticus. And here there's a whole system set up with priests apparently representing the people to God and God to the people, somebody in between. But we're going to remember that later on, the same Jesus who gave Moses the directions for setting up a priesthood in between, here in person with his disciples said, you know, there really is no need for anyone to be in between, for the Father loves you himself. And then Jesus went on to demonstrate. That's just a claim, actually, you see. We have to have a demonstration. Jesus on the cross prays for his tormentors, "Father, forgive them, they don't understand what they're doing," meaning that he had already forgiven them. Who pled with Jesus on the cross to forgive his tormentors? He says, "I forgive you, I forgive you. And if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. There's no need for anyone to plead with me. There's no need for anyone to plead with the Father." So this time, we could generously look at all the rest of the scriptures without limit as we look at these early stories and do that more than we've ever done before in the light of him saying that. And another particular place in John 15:15, where he says, "I call you no longer my servants, because servants simply do what they're told, even believe what they're told. I call you rather my friends, because I want you to understand." And so when we come to something in Genesis next time that may be difficult to understand, we're going to remember his words. Don't just believe it because it says it. I would like you to understand. And often it calls for questioning in order to understand, as some of God's friends in the Bible dared to do, and greatly worried people looking on that they would dare ask questions. So looking at the ideal that Jesus spoke just before he went out to die, keeping that in mind, he would rather we be his understanding friends. Let's look back at things in the Old Testament that sometimes seem very difficult to understand, realizing he would rather we not just say, "Well, my Bible says thus and so, and that's it." No, we're going to ask, "What does it mean? How could you drown all but eight? How could you kill the firstborn in Egypt? Some of them were little boys who'd never done anything bad in their lives. How could you do that? What does that say about you?" Remembering again that friendship, understanding, love, and trust simply cannot be commanded. If the Bible says you've got to do it, and I expect you to, and if you don't, you'll be in serious trouble, that's evidence that I think God cannot be trusted. And you may have seen that Valentine card that I particularly enjoy with the famous cat Garfield on it. And on the cover, here's the cat, who's usually in a rather irascible figure, you know, ill-tempered and impatient. He's holding his heart in his hand. It is Valentine's Day. And at the top, he says, "Be my Valentine. It's your choice. It's entirely up to you." Then when you open it up, inside it says, "Make the wrong choice, and I'll break your arm." So be my Valentine, or I'll break your arm. Does God say, "Love me, trust me, be free, don't be afraid, and if you don't do these things, I'll break your arm. It's worse than that, I'll even destroy you." Now, that would make no sense. If God is saying that, then I don't see a basis for trusting him. I see a basis for being his trembling servant, but I don't see a basis for being his understanding friend, enjoying freedom for which he paid such a price, you know, that we might know the truth that will set us free. So this time, I'd like us to dip just as much as we want to into all the books yet to come, and when we're in the middle of the Bible, not to forget all the ones we've gone through before, and see if there is a consistent picture. On this matter of claims, I imagine you've noticed that in Deuteronomy 13, and that's the fourth book, early in the Bible, that early in the Bible, God warns us to be very cautious about believing claims. You remember, Moses said, if someone should arise and give a sign or a wonder, a miracle, and the sign or wonder or miracle come to pass, but at the same time he's not telling the truth, then don't believe him, never mind the miracle. And in 1 Kings 13 is an extraordinary story coming up soon, where God told a younger prophet to deliver a certain message to the king, and having delivered it, to refuse the king's hospitality and come straight home, even by another route. And the young prophet did it, and the king was grateful and said, "Please stay for dinner." And the young prophet said, "No, God has told me I may not, and when God says something, I believe it, and that's all there's to it." So he went on his way home. An older prophet heard that this had happened, and he said to his sons, "Which way did the younger prophet go?" And his sons told him, "Oh, good," he said, "saddle my donkey. I'm going to chase after him." And he caught up with him, resting under a tree. And he said to the younger prophet, "Are you the one who sent the message to the king?" "Yes." "Oh, then come home and dine with me this day." "Oh, no," said the younger prophet. "God has told me that I may not do it." "No problem," said the older prophet. "You see, I too am a prophet of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord has told me that you may come home and dine with me this day." And the next line in the Bible is, "But he lied to him." But the younger prophet didn't know he was lying. And the position of the younger prophet was, if God has said it, I believe it, that's all there's to it. A popular bumper sticker I see on the back of cars as I drive along. And it's true, we would be willing to believe something God says. It's God who says, don't believe something just because somebody says so. Don't even believe something just because I've said so. He wants us to investigate. And so the younger prophet went home with the older prophet. And later on, when he went on his way, a lion slew him in the way, and later on we should look at the story in more detail. Why would that be in the Bible if not to warn us that even if a religious leader comes along and says, I am a prophet of the Lord, and the angel of the Lord has told me thus and so, be polite. Love is always polite. But check it out before you believe it. To me, one of the greatest evidences that the Bible can be trusted is that it warns us not to be too quick to believe, that we should investigate. And, of course, the ultimate example. See, we're looking ahead, you see, before we read. And I think this time it would be valuable to do it. The story of Jesus himself, the Son of God, after his resurrection, on the way to Emmaus, and the Bible tells in Luke of two disciples, full of questions, because the one they had hoped would be the Messiah and set up the kingdom had died, been crucified, though they had heard that maybe he'd been resurrected. They were puzzled, and they had legitimate questions. And Jesus walked with them on the way to Emmaus, but he did not reveal who he was. Now, those who like to exercise authority are puzzled that Jesus wouldn't say, now you know who I am. All right, do you have any questions? Well, here are my answers. Well, he could be somebody who's lying. He could be a false prophet. And so Jesus did not reveal who he was until he had led them through the Old Testament and until they had come to an intelligent confidence based upon unquestionable evidence. Then when they realize what the truth of the matter was, he said, by the way, you know who I am. And he showed that by the way he broke bread at the table. He said, oh, we've been with the Lord all this time. I hope they wondered about the most important thing that was revealed that day, which was that that's the way God leads people to trust him. Not by making claims, but on the basis of the accumulation of evidence. That Emmaus story is tremendous. And I would like us to do this freely and dip into future books and come back. So to me, the 66 books are a record of the evidence that God has shown that he really is worthy of our trust, even our love and our reverence and respect. And yet even after he's won us to trust him so, he doesn't say, just believe something because I say so. Believe it because of all the evidence, and that's the content of the 66. Well, going back to something you said, why don't we just collect statements? I mean, it would be so efficient, and we tend to do that in Bible class. Like, what is God like? Answer, 1 John, God is love. That's so quick, and it's so neat. You know, you can put the notes down, God is love. Of course, it could be a false prophet lying to us. God says, don't just believe it because I say so. Have you found that I am? Or does God love us? And immediately, the computer prints out John 3:16, God so loved the world. But what about the texts in the Bible that don't seem so kind and friendly? They're the ones we usually don't accumulate in our collection of texts. And for example, mention some. You've already mentioned some where God doesn't seem too kind. Like, to get started, right there in the Bible, in Genesis, he says, you may eat of all the other trees in the garden, but you may not eat of this one. In the day you eat of it, you will die.
Sounds a little arbitrary.
You know, right off. So it would not be the first text to show that God is loving and can be trusted. But it's God speaking, so it ought to rate rather high. Of course, the real question is, what do you mean you will die? Does it mean I'll kill you? Does it mean if I catch you eating of that tree, I'll kill you? That really is saying something about God, so we have to ask what it means. We've mentioned the flood already. Any others you can think of from going through so far?
In reading in Joshua, having them go in and take over land and killing everyone, it seems so cruel and harsh.
That's a whole story then. What about if we could just take statements that would really qualify as God's claims about himself?
Ten Commandments.
Yeah, I was going to say Mount Sinai.
I'm the God that brought you out of Egypt, and I'm good and long-suffering, etc., etc.
And how about reading a little further into Deuteronomy, and if you don't do things my way,
this is what will happen to you.
And when you go into battle, you should not just kill the soldiers.
The women and children and all their animals.
And Sodom and Gomorrah.
And Achan. You know, not only was Achan killed, but his family and all their pets and his brothers and his sisters were also destroyed. They had no hand in that taking of the Babylonian garment and gold and silver.
Dana, did you react to that? I've met with lots of groups of children around the country and even overseas, and I have found the children particularly are troubled that not only was Achan stoned, but Mrs. Achan and all the little Achans, and you mentioned their pets too. Did you ever worry about that story?
Well, it doesn't really seem fair. I mean, it's like my dad going out and committing a crime and the police coming to say, well, I mean, you're related to him. That means you must be bad too. Wham, I'm dead. Back up. What are you doing this for? And then, you know, the cat really helped in that crime, I'm sure. And so, you know, they're killing all these things that probably didn't even know he had done it, and that doesn't seem right.
How about the death penalty for stealing something?
Well, if it was put to this day, I don't think very many people would be alive.
And who did he ask to stone them?
Everybody else.
You mean their neighbors?
Yeah.
Their friends and...
That would not... I personally would not enjoy killing one of my good friends, especially if they were not the actual one for doing something.
Well, thinking about a lot of other stories, say, in the Old Testament coming up right away, God came down to speak to his people at Sinai. And there was thunder and lightning and earthquake, and you may have seen paintings of the Sinai experience, and God looks so very fearsome. But then the same God comes to the Mount of Olives later on, and he sits there very quietly, and he even begins to shed tears as he looks down over the people and says, you wouldn't come to me and let me talk to you. And that would puzzle them, because at Sinai, God said, don't come too close, put a fence around the mountain. If anybody breaks through the fence, he's to be stoned or shot. So which is the favorite story, the Mount of Olives or Mount Sinai? And yet they're both in there. They're both in there. And that illustrates the necessity each time to see if we can recreate the setting within which these things have occurred, sometimes called the context. Unless we can find out what was going on at the time, we're hardly in a position to understand why God would so speak or so act. And that would take up, I think, much of our time, is recreating the setting. And that's where there are books that are so very helpful. This is where archaeologists are very helpful and historians are very helpful. And there are very wonderful illustrated books nowadays that will help us recreate the setting, let us know how the people all around the children of Israel were worshiping those days. That helps us to understand why God would say, don't do this, that, or the other. Because we find the people around them who didn't believe in God were doing those things, and sometimes it had a rather unpleasant meaning. And so God would say, don't do it. So we should spend some time illustrating the setting. Did you mention Judges a while ago?
Yes.
That's one of the most extraordinary books in the Bible, where truly it says, in those days every man did that which was right in his own eyes, and some of it is hardly readable. And there are some stories I have never heard mentioned in the pulpit, like the Levite and his concubine. Though I had mentioned that so often around here that ultimately the pastor of our university church asked me if I would please preach on that. And the next week a big sign appeared outside the church that I would explain the Levite and his concubine, that dreadful story. One surely needs to put everything in the book of Judges in the total setting. But the most helpful suggestion ever made was in an early group many years ago, at least 35 years ago, and I mentioned some stories like that dreadful one in the book of Leviticus. A student who was anticipating studying medicine later on, I can see him sitting over by the window and putting his hand up and said, if you took one of the home health guide books that are made available to the public, which are often well illustrated, and you cut out all the pictures of cancer of the tongue, and he named a lot of other ailments that in color don't look very pleasant. He said, supposing you just included all those pictures and all the descriptions of disease and just printed that, the book would be repulsive and absolutely useless. He said the only justification for having all those pictures and those descriptions of illness, the only justification is that they are presented within the setting of the remedy. And I thought that's the best thing I've ever heard, and I've used it ever since. In the Bible, we have lurid descriptions of sin. Sometimes, so much so that we tend to skip these stories with our children and even with adults, and they don't get preached on in the pulpit. Well, the only justification for putting those stories in the Bible is that they are all presented within the setting of the remedy. Now, there have been individuals who have written whole books on those unpleasant stories and published them alone, and I brought one along. I brought the milder one along. It's called The Bible Unmasked. I brought the one that doesn't have the illustrations in. That's even more incredible. And this gentleman, who describes himself in the beginning as an absolute unbeliever, though he grew up with the Bible, he says, "Mothers, would you allow your children to read a book that contains all these stories?" But he says, "I've taken these all out of the Bible." He said, "I maintain the Bible is absolutely unfit to read," because he simply laid the stories end to end. And he left out the whole remedy. He left out the whole setting. So to me, that's a great illustration of the loss that occurs if you just read a little here and a little there in the Bible. Hear a story and there a story, and then pick out only the nice stories and skip all the bad ones. The Bible in the New Testament, commenting on the Old, never suggests that these parts are useful and those are not. It just says, in many and various ways God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. And Jesus, on the road to Emmaus, spoke about the whole Old Testament as bearing witness to him. And in John 5:39, he said, "The scriptures testify of me." And he never limited it. So we don't want to leave out any part. But in order to be able to use these unpleasant stories, one must recreate the total setting within which these things occurred. Another part of context is, of course, the language that's used is part of the setting. And we would need to pay a little attention to the language, not to get too complicated. For example, in the story in John 20, after the resurrection, you remember that story? What did Jesus say when Mary fell at his feet to worship him?
Did he tell her to tell the disciples he was there, or that he was in a hurry? I can't quite remember.
Oh, that's getting closer and closer to it, isn't it? The extraordinary thing that puzzles people is, here Mary was so happy to see him, she fell at his feet to worship him, and he said, "Don't touch me. Touch me not." Now, why couldn't she touch him? Well, he says, "I've not yet ascended to my Father." Meaning, if she had touched him, he couldn't have ascended to his Father, and the whole plan of salvation would have come to nothing. That doesn't make sense. Why would he say, "Don't touch me"? Of course, if you're using other versions in the Bible, it may not say, "Don't touch me." In the language in which the Gospel of John was originally written, it says, "Do not detain me. Do not go on holding to me." It didn't matter if Mary had touched him. What difference would it have made? But in those days, greetings took a little time. And so Jesus says, "Don't detain me. I've not yet ascended to my Father, but I'll be back and go and tell the disciples. I'll meet them in Galilee." And that all makes good sense. When at the feast in Cana of Galilee, which comes up in the Gospel of John again, a book that has so many stories of Jesus' life, the one who said, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father," they ran out of wine at the wedding reception, and Jesus' mother comes to him and says, "They have run out of wine." What did Jesus say to his mother? Well, again, it depends, you see, on the language you may have read this story in. In the best known of all versions of the Bible, he said, "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" And I could remember, well, Dana, did you ever say that to your mother when she said, "Would you help dry the dishes?" Did you ever say, "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" I won't ask you what would have happened, or if your daddy had heard you say that. And when I read that years and years ago, I knew it must be different from that. And I remember sitting with a group which included a wonderful Jewish scholar who specialized in the language of that particular period. He said, in the original language that Jesus was speaking to his mother in Aramaic, that was totally polite. It was really, "Mother, why would you bring that particular problem to me?" I mean, it was strange. He'd never performed a miracle yet. He just was inquiring, and it becomes perfectly polite. Or when Jesus was lost in the temple, a story told in Luke, and his parents looked for him for 3 days and three nights, and when they finally found him, they said, "How could you do this to us?" And he replied, well, it depends what language you read this in, or what version you read this in. He replied, "How is it that you were looking for me? Wist ye not that I must be about my Father's business?" And I know as a boy, if I had got lost, in the big city of London over in England, and my father had looked for me for 3 days and three nights. And I had said, "How come you were looking for me? Didn't you know I'd be busy?" I think he might have left me there in London and not taken me home. He didn't say any such thing. He said, "Didn't you know I'd be here in my father's house? You told me when I got lost to stay right where I was." He was only 12. Only 12, excuse me, Dana. He was 12. Maybe not close to 13 the way you are. "And we will look for you." And he stayed right there. And his parents found him right where they had left him. He was a good boy. Of course, he did say, "my father's house," referring to the temple. So it was an important comment that he recognized that the temple didn't belong to Joseph. He knew that. But belonged to his father, the one who was worshipped there. So language is important, not to dwell on that too long, but the version, the translation you use is very significant. I have between 200 and 300 at home in English that I like to compare. I'm wondering which one you'll use this time. When you were a little girl reading the Bible, Janie, what version did you use? Can you remember?
We had to use the King James.
It was the King James. Even with the whists and the whats and so on.
Very
and
difficult.
It's the most influential version there's ever been, and I love it. I even have a 20-pound replica of the original, just the way it was. What version will you use this time?
The Good News.
Have you liked it so far?
Yes.
It's very, very readable, and it's put out by the American Bible Society, and you know, their only concern is that people enjoy the Bible and understand it. First time you read the Bible, Connie, what version?
King James.
Same for you, Bob?
No, I read the paraphrased Bible, the Living Bible, first.
Was your first Bible?
First time through was with the Living Bible.
Now, looking back, do you feel you had the advantage of finding the Bible very readable because you used the Living?
That's right. I had tried to read the King James, and as Connie had said, when I got, like her, when I got into the Leviticus, Deuteronomy area, I found it extremely difficult at times to keep my interest. And so once you fall off the wagon, you tend to never get back on again. You dance around and never finish. So I decided I was going to go through the Living Bible because I could read it. It was much more easily understood, and I did.
How about for you, Dana? Which one did you read first?
I would get lots of children's Bibles, and they wouldn't really be a version. The very first Bible that I had, I think it was called the Children's Bible or something, and it was pink.
I've examined all the Bibles in English that I know of to see if you really can trust all of them, and I must say you can. Oh, there are a few really unusual ones, but they're very, very few. In fact, I brought one along. It's called The New Testament as Corrected by the Spirits.
Oh,
well, it really doesn't purport to be in the main line of the other versions. It's a most extraordinary Bible. It came out in 1861. And it's the choice of those who like to communicate with departed spirits. And this Bible, it presents itself as the New Testament, explains that Jesus came down from heaven and corrected all the errors in the Bible. So it's greatly changed. And it ends with the claim that this is absolutely trustworthy. And you can read this, and this would be the purified New Testament. That sort of labels itself as one would want to look at rather carefully. But all the main ones down through the years, whether Protestant or Roman Catholic or Jewish, they were all done by most conscientious individuals and committees. And they all had concern about their reputation as scholars. And, you know, if there was any evidence that an individual had twisted the Bible to his own theological advantage, his scholarly reputation would be terminated right there. The great protection in the use of the versions is that we have the Hebrew, the Aramaic, and the Greek that we can go back and check. And so I have found that while there's great variation, and there are versions that I prefer to others, and sometimes there's a translation that I personally don't think is the best one, I would recommend all of them, the one that you like the most. Do you have many others, maybe some that are noticeably different
from
the ones you've used so far?
I have a question. Who decided what books would go into the Bible in the first place?
That's the thing. For example, if you pick up a recommended Roman Catholic version of the Bible, you will find extra books. You'll find the same books, though, in certain Protestant versions of the Bible, but not in the same place. the so-called apocryphal books. I thought the time we might really talk about those would be when we come to the period during which most of them were written, between the last book in the Old Testament and the first book in the New. But since some will be confronted with this immediately, one does need to say something. There appear to be, in many printings of the Bible, an additional, well, even the number varies, around 14 extra books with names like Maccabees and Esdras and the Wisdom of Solomon and Ecclesiasticus, that often gets confused with Ecclesiastes and so on. And they're very interesting reading, and they're not without value. They were written at that period by people who believed those things, and we can learn a great deal from them. But years ago, it was Luther who was the first to gather them in the middle separately and say they're useful and interesting to read, but not for doctrine. And the Roman Catholic scholars responded, yes, they are equal, and the discussion about this has gone on ever since. Though it was a very famous Roman Catholic scholar in the around 400 AD who, at the Pope's request, was preparing a new Latin Bible to be received by all, by the name of Jerome, who first indicated publicly that these extra books, which he did not find that the Orthodox Jews were using, were really perhaps not meriting an equal place in the Bible, and he wanted to leave them out way back then in 400 AD. But people had been accustomed to them, and so he did leave them in. Ultimately, one, if one has the time, ought to read them all and decide for oneself how they compare with the ones that we call the 66, the Protestant Old Testament and New Testament canon. But every once in a while, I think we should look in there. It helps us understand what the thinking of the people was when Jesus came. It helps understand why some of them found he didn't match the Messiah that they were looking for. But anyway, if a version has those extra books, I certainly wouldn't lay it down and not use it. It is a little difficult, say, in Catholic Old Testament, because these extra books are part of, like Daniel has several of these books woven into Daniel. And you might not know when you're reading a so-called apocryphal book or when you're reading the book that the Orthodox Jew recognizes as the Old Testament canon. It's a long story. Lots of books have been written about it. It's not a matter of ignorance and no information. Ultimately, I wouldn't want anybody to tell me you can read this one with authority and not that one. So long ago, I sat down and read them all through. There are other extra books that didn't make it, both in the Old Testament and in the New. And I remember the one time I wanted to read every one of them, from Genesis to Malachi, through all the Apocrypha, and then all the other Old Testament apocryphal books called pseudepigrapha, meaning falsely titled, and all the New Testament books, and then all the New Testament apocryphal books, which most folk have never seen, apocryphal Gospels and Epistles and Acts and Revelations. And then after just a few days of reading almost nonstop, I sat back and thought, those 66 are really in a class by themselves. But I'm not afraid to read the others. They're very interesting, amazing miracle stories, and some are extremely amusing, and some are very harsh and very cruel. The first Christian description of eternally burning in hell is in one of the apocryphal New Testament books. So we don't want to act as if they don't exist. And if someone picks up a Bible that has them in, yes, take note that they're in there. And the tendency more recently is for Protestant whole Bibles to include them in the middle. And you can buy them, and many of our readers may have them there. It won't bite you to read those extra books. I find them very entertaining and seriously very informative. Well, now, I'm suggesting that next time, if you could reread the book of Genesis, or maybe read it for the first time, from creation down through the flood, the burning of Sodom and Gomorrah, the wonderful story of Abraham, God's friend, who was not afraid to ask God questions, noting all the way through the basic question, what does this say about God? And if it should seem a little overwhelming at times that God would be doing the things that he's doing, remember the words of Jesus, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. And the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 10:4, the one who led Israel back in those days was Christ himself. And it wouldn't make any difference anyway, because if we've seen Jesus, we've seen the Father. So the one who is just as gracious as the Son or the Son himself. It makes no difference. This gracious God who reveals himself in such a winsome way in the Gospels is the one who is at work there in Old Testament times. And we should ask ourselves, perhaps, how gentle Jesus could you drown the babies in the flood? How gentle Jesus could you kill the firstborn in Egypt? And do that very candidly. And that's where, if one has had the privilege of reading ahead, and how wonderfully Jesus treated, say, the woman taken in adultery, whereas in the Old Testament it says adulterous women should be stoned. And I ask, how could you, who said to that woman, I don't condemn you either, just go home and be a better girl from now on, how could you in the Old Testament say that such women should be stoned?